This program is brought to you by the Practicing Law Institute, a nonprofit learning organization dedicated to keeping attorneys, professionals, and accountants at the forefront of knowledge and expertise.
Hello and welcome to the Insecurities Podcast, keeping it fresh and staying wonky on the latest securities, regulatory, and enforcement developments with a practitioner's perspective on the stories you should be following. As always, I'm Chris Ekimoff, and I'm again back here with my good friend and co-host, Kurt Wolf. Good to be with you, sir.
Yeah, it's good to be with you, Chris. I feel like we've been ships passing for the last several episodes.
A lot of emails, not a lot of recording together, right? That's how it's
going. Yeah, I mean, I appreciate you taking the laboring oar. We'll keep this ship analogy going here. Really, really loved your live from the SEC Speaks episode last week. I thought that was great. I was super sorry to miss it, of course, but glad you could be there, mic in hand.
Yeah, it's one of those times when you can reflect on how you connect with folks that you work with regularly. Every person I know and met with at the conference first said hello and then said, "Where's Kurt?" So that's how I know that I just bring so much value to their lives that they're immediately looking for you, Kurt, instead of me.
I bet that's not the case, but I appreciate the sentiment. It was good to hear from our friend J.W. Verrett again. He's always there to pinch hit when we need somebody to step in, and always very insightful. And enjoyed hearing some of the folks from PLI who were on hand to make that conference work. It is one of my favorite events of the year. I was sorry to miss it. One of my other favorite things that we do throughout the year is check in with our good buddy, George Wilson from PLI's SEC Institute, or the SECI. I'm going to run through it quickly. Anyone who's been listening for a while knows that the SECI offers up-to-date SEC reporting, compliance, and accounting education through innovative programs and workshops, all of which are an important part of PLI's mission to keep attorneys, accountants, and professionals ever current, ever prepared, and ever aware. Every quarter, the SECI puts out a helpful newsletter that discusses current SEC focus areas, along with any new rules or rulemaking proposals, new accounting standards and proposals from the FASB, the PCAOB, and any other inspection or examination developments that might be happening in the field. We're going to talk a little bit about the SECI's latest quarterly newsletter today, as we do a couple of times a year, with one of our very favorite guests who I've mentioned, SECI's own George Wilson.
Guys, it is an absolute delight to be here again with you. And I have to say, being here for the emotional high of this reunion podcast for you two, I won't mention how you're both dabbing at your eyes in joy with Kleenex, but it's good to be with you guys again. Thanks again for the opportunity to be here and just ruminate and talk about all the fun stuff going on in our world.
George, we always challenge each other with knowledge, with insights, and maybe with a little bit of trivia. To kick it off, can you tell me, George, what number appearance this is for you on the Insecurities Podcast from PLI?
Whoa, that's a really good question. I'm going to guess seven.
Seven. You took the under, George. It is your ninth appearance.
Wow.
You are one of our stalwarts dating back to March 2020, which I'm sure many listeners didn't even know, Kurt, we had a podcast back then. We've got you on episodes 19, 32, 45, 60, 73, 91, and 103. And I'll say we have worked, I think, very aggressively to put together some great titles of those episodes. FASB the Climate and SOX Oh My is a great one, leaning into a little bit of the Wizard of Oz. We talked a little bit about the CorpFin candy dish, which, George, after we talked about C&DIs as the candy dish at Speaks last week, every time someone from accounting brought up a C&DI, all I could think about was a bowl of jelly beans. And then we, obviously, our last episode, we talked about same as last year being Lay Down Sally, a good popular music reference. So for those of you who don't know George or are listening for the first time, George is the director of the SEC Institute division of PLI. George constantly is imparting his knowledge to folks at PLI through workshops dealing with SEC and FASB related topics, such as advanced accounting and reporting for SEC professionals, as well as some more technical areas like accounting for derivative instruments and hedging activities, and the dreaded, albeit a little bit less scary, SOX 404 ICFR audits, at least these days. So we always love, George, having you on. I know you and I get to wonk out a little bit more on the accounting stuff, a lot of which we'll cover today.
And hopefully we'll have some legal fun along the way.
Also. Oh, that's right. Kurt is back. So yeah, we can.
I think we will. Yeah, as we always do, we're going to pluck out some of the topics that we found really interesting in the latest edition of the SECI quarterly newsletter. We're going to focus today on some SEC rulemakings and some auditor updates that have taken place within the last couple of months. Get your take on those. But George, we always ask you, for anybody who doesn't subscribe to the SECI quarterly newsletter, where can they find it? How can they sign up?
Easy to sign up. You just go to the pli.edu webpage and you'll find a link there to SEC Institute, or just Google search SEC Institute or ask your artificial intelligence engine to find SEC Institute. And the cool thing about it is, as you scroll down through all of our offerings, you'll find a link to the Insecurities podcast, as well as a place where you can sign up for the quarterly newsletter.
Thanks for that.
And I would say we try to keep everything brief in the newsletter. So it's really nice for me to be able to sit down with you guys and have a chance to go into a little more depth.
Yeah, it is very digestible. I love that you keep it tight with lots of links if you want to go learn more, which is always helpful, including to outside sources and any PLI programs or resources that are available. It's very well done. Highly recommend anyone listening. Please go sign up for the newsletter. But in the meantime,
you already know the podcast.
Yeah. So. Yeah, they already know the podcast. All right. Let's get into the newsletter a little bit here. We're going to focus on some rulemakings first. And where else could we start but with the climate-related disclosures rule? This saga has been going on for quite some time. Way back in March 2022, the commission proposed rules that would require registrants to disclose certain climate-related information in registration statements and annual reports. Just about a month ago, in March 2024, the SEC finally adopted the final climate-related disclosure rules. The final rules require registrants to disclose, among other things, material climate-related risks, activities undertaken to mitigate or adapt to such risks, information about how the registrant's board of directors oversees climate-related risks and management's role in managing climate-related risks, and information on any climate-related targets or goals that are material to the registrant's business, results of operations, or financial condition. The final rules also require disclosure of Scope 1 and or Scope 2 greenhouse gas emissions that will be required on a phase-in basis, depending, I believe, on the size of the registrant. I would just note that this was actually a break from the rulemaking proposal, which would have required disclosures relating to Scope 3 emissions as well. Shortly after the final rules were adopted, again, it's only been about a month, but the Fifth Circuit U.S. Court of Appeals jumped in and gave an administrative stay of the SEC's climate-related disclosure rules pending further review by that court. There's been a lot going on, George. We've talked about it on the podcast. We've talked about it with you on the podcast. I'm not even sure quite where to start. So why don't you direct us? What would you flag from the final rulemaking that we saw a month ago?
Well, there's so much going on here. But if you think big picture, there are essentially three broad categories of disclosure. So the first one, I think these are pretty straightforward, are governance and risk-related disclosures. So, you know, what's the board's involvement in oversight of climate-related risk? How does management get involved with all this stuff? And then information about risks and targets and goals. I think those disclosures are relatively straightforward. And I would suggest that everybody should start thinking about those disclosures because they will, I think, likely survive any challenge in the courts or otherwise. The greenhouse gas emission disclosures, and it's interesting because, as you said, Kurt, they will apply to large accelerated and accelerated filers. And those are far more challenging. But here's where I want to just do a little time out and toss in a little bit of trivia. So here's some trivia for us. First question. And just think of yourselves, you're sitting at the local pub, you're getting ready for the big basketball game that will be actually tonight. And you're playing the trivia game, you've got the little trivia console in front of you. And so here's the first question. How many companies are listed on the New York Stock Exchange? Ballpark figure. Now, you know, you think about that and you kind of scratch your head and don't feel like you have to guess. Mm-hmm. But do you want to guess? Do you want to take a guess?
I should know because I quoted this statistic like a month and a half ago in the law school class I'm teaching to sort of say, like, these are how many registrants there are. This is how many investment advisors there are. Yeah. And I am completely blanking. Chris, maybe you know.
As any good accountant will, I'm gonna rely on an answer that has a deep range in it. So I'm going to say thousands. Sure.
Thousands. Yes, I like that. So, final answer, thousands.
So at least 1,000, maybe 2,000. That's my guess.
Yeah. Actually, there are currently about 2,300 companies listed on the
So close. Nice.
And these are ballpark numbers. So mm-hmm. next question, how many companies are listed on the NASDAQ?
Maybe 1,000?
I'm going to say more.
You're correct. Well, it's a split.
I know. We've been apart for so long.
If we were in the same room, I'd ask you guys to arm wrestle for it.
But we'd both lose that one.
It's over 5,000.
So oh, really?
That's about 7,000 companies. And there are actually about 8,000 listed companies in the U.S. And okay. So, of course, there are companies that are on other exchanges. And you know, the NYSE is actually in an interesting process to kind of consolidate everybody on the same trading platform.
Right. Mm-hmm.
But here's the trick question. How many companies report under the 34 Act? Because this is the population of companies that will actually have to grapple with these climate disclosures. And the number there, I'll just go, you guys know I'm terrible with numbers, and you can see I'm reading from my notes here. But so this is from a recent final rule where they always in the economic analysis section sort of parse this stuff out. There are approximately 6,870 companies that file on domestic forms, 10Q, 10K, et cetera, which includes some foreign private issuers. Mm-hmm. I think it's actually less than 100. And then there are about 920 companies that file on the FPI forms, 20F and 6K. So all told, you know, that's, you know, somewhere around 7,700 companies, 7,800 companies. That's the population that's going to be affected by this rule. Now, 34% of those companies are large accelerated filers and 10% are accelerated filers. So all those companies are going to have to grapple with the governance and risk and target disclosures. 44% of them will have to grapple with the greenhouse gas related disclosures. And about 57% of all the registrants out there are smaller reporting companies or emerging growth companies who are exempted from those disclosures. So I mentioned the governance disclosure is pretty straightforward. The greenhouse gas disclosures that large accelerated and accelerated filers are going to have to grapple with takes you into some pretty technical stuff, which I don't think we want to talk about. But scope one are kind of, you know, everybody's heard these definitions so many times, I don't even want to repeat them. But I want to go out and measure my house's scope one emissions, because I think I should disclose that. And to do that, what I'm going to do is I'm going to take a probe and go stick it in the smokestack from my furnace and use a physical measurement. I mean, that's scope one directly.
Perfect.
Scope two, I can get from my local utility. That's the stuff from using the energy that I use. Those are not that tough to measure. And if you go to the Greenhouse Gas Initiative, it's there. But if you think about the companies that are going to be affected by this, particularly the S&P 500, who are probably, I forget the exact, it's over 95% of the total market cap. Many of them are already disclosing this. Mm-hmm. So it is when you try to temper this, what's reasonable, and then ask the question, what do investors really want to know, need to know? What's going to be material? There's a lot going on here. So Kurt, you mentioned it in the Fifth Circuit, there was already a challenge, Liberty Energy and a couple other companies. They put a stay in place. There were a whole bunch of other suits filed, and they did I'm not sure how this works with the circuit courts, Kurt, but they did a lottery. And I'm picturing all the attorneys doing scratch-off tickets to figure out where they would consolidate. I think there were eight cases that got consolidated into the Eighth Circuit. And then just last week, we put up a blog post, and it's been well publicized that the SEC voluntarily stayed the rules while all this litigation proceeds through the Eighth Circuit. So the other part we haven't even touched on, I saved the best for last, are all of the accounting-related disclosures. And for accounting-related disclosures, they fall into two broad categories. If you have climate-related expenses, charges in your income statement of operations, if those are over 1% of your pre-tax income, absolute value, you would have to make disclosure of those amounts. But then if you have climate-related capital expenditures and other things that go on the balance sheet, you would have a threshold of 1% of your consolidated shareholders' equity. Again, absolute value. And anything over those thresholds would have to be disclosed. And those, I don't know how you feel about it, Chris, but that to me imposes kind of an artificial materiality threshold that just makes me shiver a little bit when I think about those.
You hit on a good point there, George, about just kind of that arbitrary is not the right word, but that pre-selected value, right?
Perfect word.
Could be more, could be less for anybody. And obviously, for some companies with a lot of focus on this area, right, materiality will be much more qualitative than quantitative. It always comes out better than you think about it. I'm interested, George, in kind of your take of the development, right? I'll say we're at the end of the road, even though we're not. You know, we've had this final rule issued, but there's obviously more questions. How do you feel about the impact of the comment letter process, right? This has been a main focus. Kurt, you referenced our original discussions back in 2022. There's been a lot of talk here. Did we head in the right direction? Stakeholders that participated in the comment letter process heard, or was this more of a rule that was decided before things were discussed?
You know, I see compromise and practical expediency in the final rule. If you read the commissioner's speeches, or if you were listening to the meeting and you heard them actually deliver their remarks at the meeting where the rule was adopted, the nature of the remarks really took you to the term polar opposites. Commissioner Peirce and her Republican colleague talked about how this was totally outside the purview of the SEC. Commissioner Crenshaw and her Democratic colleagues talked about how the rule did not go far enough. And one of the Democratic commissioners said they almost withheld their vote because they didn't think it went far enough. I think this is a great example of how within our markets, there's huge diversity in what people think and what they want. And it's, of course, become very politicized. So I think this rule is very much structured as sort of a compromise. And if you take the time and drink enough coffee to read the economic rationalization for the rule, it's very thoughtfully put together, I think, to sort of overcome some of those concerns. And I really believe that it's a practical rule. I'm a simple country accountant from northern Minnesota. I actually like to understand climate-related stuff, but I don't think I need as much as the SEC is pushing for. At the same time, this is the sort of thing that's always been controversial. I think Chair Gensler's remarks went back historically and talked about some of the times when people fought new disclosures vehemently. I can remember when MD&A was created and people were saying the SEC has no purview to require this kind of discussion in a company's annual report. It's about financial statements. That does take you back to 1980, and I just want to say I had only been practicing for about 5 years back then. But I think it's fascinating to watch the process play out, and it's like democracy. It is a hugely messy process. It's, who was the famous senator who talked about it as a process similar to making sausage? You might like, who was, I forget, but you might like the end result, but you sure don't want to see how it's made. So we'll see where it goes. So is that long-winded and vague enough as an answer?
Yes. Perfect podcast, George.
This is one of the reasons why I like to stay engaged with what we do, because it's a fascinating process. And ultimately, I'm confident that ultimately it will serve the needs of investors as they evolve.
I want to press you a little bit for a prediction here, George. When we talked about it a couple of years ago, one of the things that you flagged was that a bunch of the comment letters were calling for moderation, right? They they sort of said, we think that the rule as proposed went a little bit too far. Yeah. It sounds like what you're saying is maybe they did find some moderation in the final version of the rule, yet we are still in this posture where, you know, the rule faces numerous legal challenges. And, you know, the folks or the companies that are challenging it are saying things like, the rule fails to satisfy the major questions doctrine, which basically says Congress doesn't delegate to the SEC the authority to require climate risk disclosure. Sort of climate issues are major political or economic questions that are beyond the SEC's purview. Of course, they say the rule is arbitrary and capricious. They say that anytime they don't like a rule. You know, this one's interesting because it requires disclosure. One of the challenges is that the rule violates the First Amendment by requiring companies to speak. And again, we're going to think of companies like people in this context. Meanwhile, the SEC says, listen, if there is any harm whatsoever on the horizon, it's way too remote because these rules don't go into effect until March 2026 at the earliest, and maybe even later now that the SEC has kind of pumped the brakes on this. You know, the SEC has also said that the folks challenging the rule are unlikely to succeed on the merits because they, quote, fit comfortably within the SEC's longstanding authority to require the disclosure of information important to investors in making investment and voting decisions and are consistent with the SEC's prior exercise of that authority, end quote. Right. So we've got this sort of important philosophical debate about SEC rulemaking playing out. To your point, George, we are kind of seeing how the sausage is made, but the backdrop is a rule that the SEC pared back.
Yes.
So I guess I just wonder how do you think this play ends? Because it's a really interesting drama so far.
Well, I'm going to say the last time you asked me a question like that, Kurt, was about, it was in 2022 when the rule had been proposed the previous March.
Yeah.
And I think I said, I bet it'll be done before the end of the year.
You did, but I wasn't going to call you out because I said the same thing, George. You know, no, it was me too.
You can totally call me out. I only missed by a year and 3 months. So, you know, I think that is not a real miss. No, my total guess is that the governance-related parts of the rule will probably survive. And in response to your questions about the comment letters, the SEC's release, which everybody talks about, is over 800 pages long. The thing I love about when people talk about the 800-page rule is if you go and look at the actual incremental guidance that was put into Regulation SK and the incremental guidance that was put into Regulation SX, it's like 25 pages. It's not that long to read it, but all the discussion about it, the other like 800 pages in that release are all of the discussion about the comment letters.
Yeah.
And there really are, I think, some thoughtful incorporation of the comments into the final rules. For example, there's no requirement to talk about climate-related expertise on the board level. And the person I think probably most disappointed about that is Al Roker. He would have been asked to be on so many boards if there was a requirement to disclose who on the board has climate-related expertise. But they drew back from that kind of stuff. As you mentioned, they took Scope 3 emissions out of the final rule. And that's an interesting thing for them to do because in California, as you know, the two climate-related rules that were passed by the California legislature include Scope 3 emissions. The climate-related rules going into effect in the European Union include Scope 3 emissions. So instead of kind of being on the leading edge or perhaps bleeding edge for those disclosure requirements, they drew back. So I think they did, in a very meaningful way, respond to the comments. And if you ask me, where do I think this will go? I think they've built their case pretty carefully. And I think while there may be some tweaks in some of the greenhouse gas-related disclosures, and I'm just going to unabashedly say, I hope there will be some tweaks in the financial statement disclosures. I think those should go back and say, if material, make these disclosures, as opposed to an arbitrary threshold. We've dealt with materiality forever, you know, since before the 33 Act, because material was always an issue in financial reporting before. before there was a Securities and Exchange Commission. And yes, it's a really difficult concept to grapple with. It is there, and we should deal with that. So I think that's where it'll end up. So, okay, so governance disclosures, substantially the same. Greenhouse gas emissions, I'm going to go probably there. Financial statement disclosures hopefully fall back to use a regular materiality threshold. And what's the date? Today is April, whatever it is. We'll just jot that down. And a year from, well, 2 years from now.
We'll quiz you on
it. How far off we are.
Yeah. We can see, yeah. But those are my thoughts about it.
All right. Well, tell our listeners, I know there's some PLI programming coming up. You've done some work on this. What's available in the coming weeks or months for anyone who hasn't been following it closely or is trying to figure out how to get to grips with this?
Yeah, we have, well, actually on April 18th, we have 2 one-hour briefings. They'll be at 1 o'clock and 3 o'clock in the afternoon on April 18th. If you're a privileged member of PLI, they're obviously included in your membership, but if you're not, you can still come. I forget how much they cost. But the first one is going to be about governance disclosures, and one of our key SEC Institute speakers, a guy who's an attorney, Gary Brown from Nelson Mullins, is going to be there with Christina Thomas from Kirkland & Ellis. And they'll carry through a pretty good deep discussion of the governance-related matters. And then at 3 o'clock that afternoon, we'll do a separate briefing that's going to talk about the greenhouse gas emission requirements and all the stuff that goes in the accounting world. And they'll have all the up-to-date information on what's going on in the litigation process also.
That's good.
It'll be interesting to see if anything happens in the 8th District between now and when they do those briefings. And then we just scheduled this earlier today, so it's still a little tentative, but on October 7th, we're actually going to have a day-long program that does a deep dive. And we're going to have people who actually are from industry who've been, over the last several years, helping their companies to implement climate-related disclosures. And I'm just going to toss in, I'm super excited about that conference because October 7th is my birthday. So What a great present. I get the co-chair of climate-related conference.
Asking for cake or presents on October 7th, but
that's my present.
We'll be sure to drop links to those programs in the show notes for this episode so you guys can learn a little bit more about where we are today and where we may be on those dates with where the climate rules are. I want to move, George, kind of different topic, but similar time period, right? To talk about the final rules for SPACs. This is all anybody was talking about, right? In 21 and 22. Here we are in 24, maybe thinking a little bit differently about it. Just to quote from the SECI newsletter, in January, the SEC adopted new rules and amendments to enhance disclosures and provide additional investor protection in initial public offerings by special purpose acquisition companies or SPACs, and in subsequent business combination transactions between those SPACs and their target companies, colloquially known as a de-SPACing transaction. The rules more closely align the required disclosures and legal liabilities that may be incurred in de-SPAC transactions with traditional IPOs. The new rules and amendments require, among other things, enhanced disclosures about conflicts of interest, SPAC sponsor compensation, dilution, and other information that is important to investors in SPAC IPOs and de-SPAC transactions. The rules also require registrants to provide additional information about the target company to investors that will help investors make more informed voting and investment decisions in connection with that de-SPAC transaction. So, George, we've been walking this SPAC plank for a while now. Here we are with some final rules about it. Are you surprised? Anything that you think is more important than maybe the summary I just provided?
I think that was spot on, Chris.
That's good, because you wrote most of it in the newsletter. So
it is true, yeah. Yeah, the whole goal of the final rules was to make the de-SPACing transaction essentially have the same investor protections as a regular end result is the same. Here, I've got a little more statistical trivia for you. Back in 2021, there were 612 SPAC IPOs. Now, when you do a SPAC, you actually IPO the shell company, it becomes a SPAC. Mm-hmm. You avoid being a penny stock company and things like that because you've got real money in the bank. 612 in 2021. How many do you think listed in 2023?
Oh, like less than 100.
Yeah, I'd say a few dozen.
Yeah, it's actually 30. Now, those are statistics from a couple of different places. So about 30 SPACs. So I think that the SPACs, to borrow your metaphor, Chris, actually did walk the plank, but did not make that big a splash in 2023. But the final rules are out there. In all honesty, most SPAC transactions, especially the IPOs, but also especially the de-SPAC registration statements or proxy statements, were already in substance complying with these rules, because the review process was asking for most of these disclosures already. There are a couple of interesting twists. Formally, the 1995 PSLRA safe harbors for forward-looking statements won't be there for a de-SPAC transaction. And there's an interesting thing going on with like co-offerees. The company that's public, the SPAC, has been an offeree of securities. But now it looks like the private company that hasn't been public, but is sort of backdoor going public in the SPAC, is going to have the same liability and the same officer and director liability as the SPAC. And then underwriters, I think, are going to be scratching their head about this a little bit, and have been anyway. But, if you underwrite the SPAC's IPO, you may more or less be considered an underwriter in the de-SPAC transaction also, even if you've stepped away from the deal. It used to be in the SPAC world that the underwriter would take the SPAC public at a reduced fee, but also get the rest of their fee when they did the de-SPAC transaction. So I know they're interesting deals, and obviously for the sponsors, hugely profitable. Interesting to watch those go on. So we'll see where it goes. These things come in waves. So right. I expect somewhere in the future, there's going to be another huge wave of these things when there's enough appetite by private companies to want to get out into the public markets.
We always get into discussions about correlation or causation. I'm going to go with a little bit of correlation here. You talked, George, about the popularity of SPACs in 21 versus 23. Kurt, can you guess how many episodes we did on SPACs in 2021?
Oh, like... focusing on SPACs or mentioning them at all?
I mean, we broached the topic.
Man, probably like six.
I think it's about six with my quick tabulation here. Can you guess how many episodes we did on SPACs in 2023?
Probably zero.
It depends on how you count, but the right answer, I think, is zero. So I think we all got up to speed, right, and learned a bit about it back in 2021. Fast and furious. If you just started listening to Insecurities Now, or you're a recent law school graduate and the SPAC train has passed you by, you can go back to a handful of our episodes in 2021 to catch up on that. But George, if someone doesn't have time on the treadmill or the elliptical to listen to Kurt and I banter on about special purpose acquisition companies, what kind of resources does PLI put out there now that we've got this final rule on SPACs?
Well, we actually have, I think this is the third or fourth year, a one-day conference. We're doing it on April 15th, a one-day forum called the SPAC Lifecycle. And I will say, even though the number of SPACs is reduced, still one of my favorite programs, because they are fascinating transactions. Yeah. And so it'll be an all-day program, webcast and in person.
Perfect. No cake on that one, George. We'll save that for October 7th.
No cake on that one. That's fair.
All right. Well, let's switch gears here. As I often do, I want to move on to talk about accounting and auditor updates.
He's always saying that.
Wait to get there.
Can I toss in one more SEC-related thing? Because I did bring a lot.
Absolutely. Yeah, please.
So it's about... I love this, because the episode you guys did with Kelly Richmond Pope was so good, so fantastic. Literally, as soon as that was over, I went and watched her documentary, All the Queen's Horses, and was just aghast. And the CPA firm that was involved in auditing the city, that the lady who was the queen of the horses stole tens of millions of dollars from, they actually ended up paying a tens of millions of dollars settlement. So I thought I'd go back, because it really harkens home the idea of whistleblowers. One of the great points she makes is that about 35% of all frauds that are discovered and made known by whistleblowers. And so I just thought, and I always put a whistleblower blurb in the newsletter because I think it's a really important issue. I'm still hoping that I someday get to blow the whistle on someone, because it's a great way to finance your retirement. So here's my whistleblower trivia. What was the amount paid to whistleblowers in fiscal year 2023?
Oh, let's see. So I'm going to try to do the math here. We're nearing it's like 1.8 billion total in 11 years. There was one payout of, I think, 223 million last fiscal year.
I have got the numbers because I looked them all up. So I'll say there was one payout of 279 million a couple of
years. 279, that was the big one. Yeah. So it was probably like $450 million in fiscal 23.
I'm going to agree with my co-host on this one.
Yeah. Fiscal year 2023 from the Office of the Whistleblower's annual report. They paid over $600 million
just shy.
To 68 whistleblowers. Now, I grabbed my calculator earlier to do the math. That's an average of $8.8 million.
That's excellent.
Since inception, $1.9 billion. So $1.8, $1.9 billion over 397 whistleblowers. I mean, this has brought so many huge frauds to the surface. And we, in our mid-year conferences and annual conferences and our smaller reporting company conference in September, we always have an ethics component and we always talk about it. Because I think a lot of professionals, and I loved the way your episode with Ms. Kelly Richmond Pope talked about this, because in all the Queen's Horses, the person who bubbled the fraud up, who actually discovered it when the person perpetrating the fraud was away and they had to go get bank statements,
right,
didn't know what to do. And struggled with what to do and worked for several months under incredible pressure while the investigation of how big the fraud was took place and couldn't disclose to the person who perpetrated the fraud that all this was going on. I mean, it was life-changing. But I think it's a really important thing because as professionals, if we ever find ourselves in a spot where we don't think this is right, we need to remember we've got a safety net. So I will preach about that. I will preach. I'll stop preaching. But if you would open your hymnals both to number 27, we will finish.
That's a good hymn.
George, when you're ready to blow the whistle, give me a call.
I was going
to
say, I know a guy who can help.
Whistleblowers sometimes. Yeah.
Sure, your report is acceptable under the variety of programs.
I'll send you some business cards. You can leave them in your live programs any of the folks. Yeah. All right. So enough of that. Let's give the people what they want. Public Company Accounting Oversight Board updates. We're all here for the PCAOB Inspection Priorities 2024. All right, George, one of the things that you highlighted in the newsletter was an update that came from the PCAOB in December. They published what is called a spotlight report that was called Staff Priorities for 2024 Inspections and Interactions with Audit Committees. The PCAOB releases these spotlights from time to time. They did another one last April that similarly outlined some of their inspection priorities. On the SEC side, I know folks eagerly await the Division of Exams Examination Priorities memo that comes out every year. I assume the same is true in the PCAOB space, although I don't have it flagged in my calendar. So just, you know, give me a little bit of a baseline here. How often does PCAOB put out these kinds of reports? Are there meaningful changes from one report to the next in terms of inspection priorities?
What was the episode we talked about, same as last year, Sally?
Lay Down Sally, episode 103. Yeah.
It's interesting because when you look at that spotlight, and I love the way they call them spotlights, I would first say I think they issue them more or less in kind of an ad hoc basis. Mm-hmm. Over the last several years, it's been ad hoc. I suspect it will become more regular now with the current board. But they generally have two broad categories. One is what's going on in the environment that could create audit challenges. And the other are areas where they have historically found significant numbers of findings in the inspection process. And the things going on in the environment right now, well, those are, you know, kind of things you would expect. High interest rates right now, especially in the banking and financial institution world. Supply chain disruptions, all the things happening there. What are the current environmental issues where, you know, there could be a higher risk of a misstatement? Then the areas where they tend to have a fair number of findings tend to be kind of like the laundry list of areas where the SEC writes a lot of comments. And you know, in our workshops, we always emphasize the SEC doesn't write a lot of comments in areas because they think they're super important. They write a lot of comments because they find a lot of problems in those areas. Mm-hmm. And every year for the last several years, the top two comment areas have been MD&A and non-GAAP measures. And they flip-flop back and forth between one and two sometimes. But when you read the comments, the number of times companies are asked to redo or change disclosures in the future, pretty substantial. So areas like revenue recognition, so many judgments involved there, and in the new standard setting process, stuff like that. You know, if you think about the issues in impairment of long-lived assets and the estimates and fair value there, all kinds of complicated issues there. It's interesting, though, because now I think to kind of draw back to a bigger picture and look for root causes, there are a lot more comments about audit firm quality control processes. And there's been some good standard setting there. Now, Chris, you are actually one of those people. You're not actually walking the audit trail, but you hang out with people around the campfire out on the audit trail. Do you think that focus on quality control issues is one of the things that firms are thinking about?
Absolutely. And I like that we've gone from, nautical-based metaphors now to camping metaphors, George, as we're around the campfire. I think that, at any audit firm, the consideration of things like peer review and a quality control system are table stakes. And knowing that there have been some enforcement actions around accounting firms in the past few years that have, pointed to some of the mid-sized or smaller firms just not even having a program, right? I think that's obviously the exception and not the common practice. I go back to Speaks last week when Chief Enforcement Accountant Ryan Wolf was talking about the role of gatekeepers and being held to a higher standard. This is that, manifest, right? Yeah. If you are to provide some assurance around the financial reporting within the markets, you yourselves need to be able to hold yourselves to a standard that accounts for things like, audit firm culture and what's acceptable, not just what's on paper, as well as, one of the other areas of focus from the spotlight is the post-merger accounting firm, right? When accounting firms A and B join each other together, does a culture of quality permeate, or is there some other issue there that may develop? And they noted that as another inspection area in the coming year. So I think, George, when these issues arise, I'd be hard-pressed to find anyone around my campfire that would disagree with that quality or that focus on providing, on getting to that higher standard. But it's definitely something that needs to continue to be focused on.
Yeah, and I love the way you use the word culture in that discussion, Chris. There have been a couple of recent enforcements that focus on independence issues and big firm independence issues. And they're almost disheartening from my perspective. But I think that this will become a bigger part of the inspection process, and we'll see more findings in that regard. It's almost, I would actually argue, predictable. This is going to happen. When you go back to some of the recent PCAOB and SEC enforcement cases, one of them dealt with a firm that took on so many SPAC clients that they literally overwhelmed the practice.
Right.
And the practice could not do the audits appropriately, but firm leadership kept on accepting SPAC clients. And to oversimplify things, they focused on revenue generation and profitability before quality. And any firm that's going to make that as a statement of here's how we work, I think is going to get into more trouble over the years now.
And on that topic, George, overwhelming is something that is described when we move into the next thing that I'd like to talk about here, and that is the auditor's consideration of a client's non-compliance with laws and regulation. This has been one of the most discussed topics of the past 12 months. On March 6th, the PCAOB held a virtual roundtable to describe or to understand additional insights from stakeholders about this NOCLAR, the non-compliance with laws and regulations. Again, to summarize here, and this is not an official position, but basically asking an auditor to consider, does this business, run afoul of any, jurisdictional, legal issues where they operate or any other kind of non-accounting regulations that their business may be subject to? I mean, it just opens up a Pandora's box of consideration. So, George, interested in your thoughts on where we are with NOCLAR and what that means.
Oh my gosh, this is like the PCAOB's version of the climate-related rulemaking. It is opening up all kinds of fascinating doors.
Yeah.
do I, as an auditor, and I am, you know, I'm an auditor at heart. Mm-hmm. I walk the audit trail long enough. I actually go to a meeting every Tuesday. Hello, my name is George. I'm an auditor.
Hi, George.
Hi, Chris. No, I mean, it's in your blood. It's always in your spirit. You know, you just bring that to the party every time. And I'm struggling, in all honesty, with the idea that there are maybe some laws and regulations where noncompliance might start to affect the financial statements. But there are other laws and regulations where noncompliance wouldn't affect the financial mm-hmm. statement. And where's the line between those? And I would actually say we need Kurt to help us understand that. The audit should not be that dramatic a legal process in my mind. But I would actually mm-hmm. say, you know, if there is a law or regulation where noncompliance could have a material impact, I need to be thoughtful about that as an auditor. And one I would toss out is the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act. You can certainly find companies that have had material sanctions because they violated the FCPA. And is that part of the audit process? So I think this is, and then the round table that was held, there was a lot of great discussion mm-hmm. about this whole issue. I don't really know where it'll go. I think it'll be interesting to see where the board pushes it. It's a very aggressive board right now and trying to do the best they can. I think we'll hopefully respond to the comments and temper the rule a bit. But it'll be interesting to watch. And I think this is kind of like where the climate rule was in June of 2022.
I was going to sum up this section, George, with when do you think we'll have a final rule on the non-compliance with laws and regulations? And my guess is you'll say what, end of this year, and then we'll talk about it again in 26 or
I'm gonna go. I think the board has been, the PCAOB has been moving pretty aggressively through this. And I would not be shocked to see a final rule by the end of the year. But
we've got it on tape again, folks.
I'm gonna go 80%. 80% on this. No, I'm not afraid to be wrong. I'm just very uncertain on this one. Can I do one more? It's kind of whistleblower related thing. Well, we're talking about,
as long as we can plug Kurt's practice during.
All right. So,
I mentioned
this is not true whistleblower, but it's one of my favorite things about the way the PCAOB was chartered in the Sarbanes-Oxley Act. Mm-hmm. So let's say you're an accounting firm and you pay a multi-million-dollar fine because you put profitability over audit quality. And we're willing to jeopardize the interests of the investing public. When you pay that $8 million fine, where does the money go? Because got to remember, the PCAOB is not a government agency.
Right.
It's an independent, not-for-profit organization.
Yeah.
My second favorite PCAOB trivia is, do you know where the PCAOB's first offices were?
I do not.
1666 K Street, which used to be the Arthur Anderson offices in the district.
Wow. Some poetic.
That's perfect.
When you pay a fine as an auditor to the PCAOB, it actually goes into a fund that is used to provide scholarships to accounting students.
Oh.
Yeah.
So
that doesn't shock me. I mean, a lot of the money like that FINRA obtains through mm-hmm. enforcement goes for educational purposes. Mm-hmm. So it sort of makes sense.
So if you're a bad auditor, you're helping educate hopefully better auditors.
I like your rose-colored glasses version of that. Now
I'm the quintessential Pollyannish rose-colored glasses
person.
I love it.
Well, George, we always enjoy spending time with you. Obviously, for those of you interested in more of the topics on the SEC Institute's quarterly newsletter, go to the website, pli.edu. You can sign up right there and see an ad for your favorite podcast. George, you've mentioned a few programs we've got coming up through, obviously, April here, coming up shortly, as well as on someone's birthday in October. Any other programs we should have our listeners consider over the summer?
You know, if you are engaged in SEC reporting as a legal professional or accounting professional, we've got our regular curriculum, the full in-person and webcast two-day courses, and then our modular half-day essentials programs to help you get up to speed with everything going on. There's more going on than just what we've talked about today.
Of course.
So keeping current, even with cover pages. I loved the discussion at SEC Speaks from the CorpFin staff about what to do with the silly check boxes.
Yes.
Rules on the cover page. That's the first time I've heard anybody else get excited about those. I actually danced a little bit.
Birds of a feather.
when the Corp Fin chief accountant person did that.
Well, awesome. George, welcome to the Nine Timers Club. You know, we'll have to get you a jacket made, as is made famous by SNL.
No, I'll bring the cake for you guys. Thanks for the opportunity.
We appreciate it. Thanks for joining us for this episode of the Insecurities Podcast, and a special thanks to our guest, George Wilson of the SEC Institute at PLI. We always love to hear from our listeners. Look for us on social media to share your thoughts and comments or topics you'd like us to explore on future episodes of Insecurities. Please use the hashtag InsecuritiesPod on X or LinkedIn to join the conversation. You can find me at EkimoffCPA.
And I'm at Enforce_update.
Don't forget to subscribe, rate, and review Insecurities wherever you listen. Be well, everyone, and we'll see you next time.
Thanks for tuning in.
Thanks for listening to Insecurities, a podcast from PLI, the Practicing Law Institute. PLI is a nonprofit provider of authoritative professional services training and continuing education. In an increasingly complex business environment where intricate corporate structures reign, Insecurities can help you make sense of it all. A special thanks goes to the producer of Insecurities, Daniel Pinitz, as well as hosts Chris Ekimoff and Kurt Wolf. For more information about PLI's SEC Institute, or to view hundreds of hours of fresh and relevant on-demand programming covering changes within the security sector, visit pli.edu/membership and sign up for a privileged membership. These recorded materials are designed for educational purposes only. This podcast does not constitute legal, audit, tax, consulting, business, financial, investment, or other professional advice, and it does not create an attorney-client relationship. Please consult a qualified professional advisor before taking any action based on the information herein. Furthermore, the views and opinions expressed in this podcast are solely those of the individual participants. These views are not the views of the hosts or their employers. Users of this podcast may save and use the podcast only for personal or other non-commercial educational purposes. No other use, including without limitation, reproduction, retransmission, or editing of this podcast may be made without the prior written permission from PLI.